I've expanded the, I've changed the outline a bit, so I've put it on the overhead here. We'll follow it. It's mostly the same, but there's some other elements I wanted to make sure we're going to cover. We began with the three covenants God made with the people and the world in general, but now the last five, specifically with the Jewish people. I want to cover two of these tonight, the Abrahamic and Mosaic, and we'll cover the last three 2 weeks from now when we cover the last of the covenants. I remember the days we were led by the Holy Spirit, but now we have cell phones. All right. Point one scripture. The scriptures in the Abrahamic covenant are scattered throughout Genesis, but the six main passages, the first one to look at is Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. And here Abraham is called, and God's initial promise is to simply show him a land, and nothing more about the land is promised at this stage. It's simply promised to be shown a land. Furthermore, God promises to make of him a new nation. Now, two chapters earlier in Genesis chapter 10, he spelled out the 70 Gentile nations arising out of the three sons of Noah. But now he'll make nation number 71, through whom he will carry out his covenantal and salvation program. He promises to bless Abraham, and Abraham will prove to be a blessing himself. And in verse 3, he spells out the Jewish-Gentile relationship. On the one hand, those who bless the Jews will be blessed, but those who curse them will be cursed. But not the end of verse 3, it says, "Then you shall the families of the earth be blessed." And what he promises is that someday the spiritual blessings of the covenant will go out to the Gentiles. That these Jewish covenants contain both physical and spiritual promises. And while the physical promises, like the promise of the land, is limited to Jewish people only, the spiritual blessings were to extend to the Gentiles. For now, he does not tell us how this will occur, but we shall discover later on, and 2 weeks from now, that is to come by means of the new covenant. The second passage is chapter 12, verse 7, 12:7, and when he finally arrives in the land, then God extends the promise, the land will be given to his seed or to his descendants. Now, Abraham himself knows he's not yet promised the land, but the promise is given to his descendants. The third passage is chapter 13, verses 14 through 17. Chapter 13, verses 14 through 17. Where concerning his seed, he promises the seed will become numerous, in verse 16, innumerable. But now the promise of the land is specifically made to Abram, and in verses 14, 15, and 17, 14, 15, and 17, the land is promised to Abraham personally. To you, and to your seed, I will give this land. Now this comes after the separation from Lot, because they were basically strangers and vagabonds in the land. And therefore, they had to stay in the neutral zone. They couldn't feed their flock within territories owned by the various city-states of Canaan. And so there was limited land for the as wealthy as they got. And so Lot chose the better part of the country, leaving Abraham with the lesser of the land. But God promises that someday all that Abram sees, including the part that Lot took, will be his. So it says in verse 17, "Arise, walk through land, land of it and the breadth of it, unto you have I given it." And by walking the whole length of the land and the whole breadth of the land, by walking the land, he is claiming the land. That does not become a reality within his lifetime. Now, those who teach replacement theology simply often teach that God did not mean land as being something literal, but he means land as being symbolic of heaven. So what God's promising Abraham is someday he'll get to heaven. But that will render many verses meaningless, like verse 17, where he's told to rise and walk through land. What is God asking Abraham to do in verse 17? Is he saying to him, come up to heaven and spend a few days with me and see if you like the place? Verse 17 makes sense only if it's speaking about real estate. And verse 17 is significant for one main reason. What you have in verse 17 is the first ever Holy Land tour. And he's to walk the length of it, the breadth of it, and someday he'll get to own it. The fourth passage is chapter 15, verses 1 through 21, chapter 15, verses 1 through 21. Here he repeats some of the previous provisions in verses 1 through 6 that Abraham will sire a son. God does not yet make explicit that Sarah will be the mother, but he's promised a son. And in verse 7 and verses 17 through 21, verse 7 and 17 through 21, he's again promised the land, but not specific borders are given. Not so much the east-west borders, they're somewhat obvious. The west is the Mediterranean and the east is the Jordan River. But he spells out the northern and southern border. The northern border is the Euphrates River. Now, people who don't study geography closely make too many assumptions, and sometimes people have assumed that by the Euphrates River, the whole Euphrates River from Turkey all the way down to the Persian Gulf is the northern border. That's not the case. Rather, the border will come north of Lebanon. All of Lebanon is part of the Promised Land. It will move from east to west and come to the Euphrates River and only parallel Euphrates River for a few miles and then turn south, because while the Golan Heights is part of the Promised Land, Damascus, for example, is not part of the Promised Land. The southern border he gives us the River of Egypt. And again, people not knowing geography have made the assumption and sometimes teach the River of Egypt is the Nile River, so the southern border will be the Nile River. But just think, if the Nile River happens to be the southern border of the Promised Land, the Jews were in the Promised Land before they ever left Egypt. And yet they were not viewed as being in the land of promise, but still in Egypt. And while they were in Sinai, they were not viewed as being within the borders of the Promised Land. Let's distinguish between two phrases, Brook of Egypt and River Egypt. The Brook of Egypt is the what is now called the Wadi El Arish over here, which cuts in the central Sinai. And you see the word brook, that's the Hebrew word for it, the Arabic word Wadi. Wadi El Arish is the ancient Brook of Egypt, but that's not the same as the River of Egypt. The River of Egypt is something else, because as the Nile River flows, it flows from south to north, and before it empties into the Mediterranean, it splits to slope into smaller streams in the Delta region, the Nile Delta region. And the most eastern branch of the Nile Delta, the most eastern branch, was called the River of Egypt. And in fact, the Suez Canal was dug along the same river. So now we call it the Suez Canal, but in biblical times it was called the River of Egypt. And so when the Jews have all of the Promised Land, while Jewish settlement will only go as far south as the Brook of Egypt, Jewish control will continue all the way to the River of Egypt, was now the Suez Canal. And so the very northern part of Sinai is part of it, but not South Sinai. Another point to note here is that in verses 12 through 16, God also tells Abram that he will not give him the land at this stage, because the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. The Jews will wander and be enslaved, and the time of wandering and enslavement will total 400 years. So before centuries, before the conquest actually begins, 4 centuries before they begin to experience ownership of the land. So keep in mind, on one hand, God promises the land to Abram, and yet they won't start getting it for at least 4 more centuries. Now, the important thing in this chapter is that here the cup is actually signed and sealed. Now, there are different ways of signing covenants. For example, there was a hand covenant, there was a shoe covenant, there was a salt covenant, but the most solemn covenant was called a blood covenant. And when two people made a blood covenant, they would agree to terms, and then they would take one or more animals. They would kill the animals by shedding blood. Then cut the animals in half and line them up in rows. And then the two people making the covenant walked between the pieces of the animals. And because both of them walked through the animals together, it rendered the covenant conditional. And what they were saying is, may my blood be shed like this animal blood was shed if I don't keep the terms of the covenant. And if one person failed and forfeited his life, it freed the other one from fulfilling his obligations. The point of similarity is here found in verses 8 through 11. In verse 8 through 11, Abraham is told to take several animals, kill them by shedding blood, cut them in half, line them up in rows. But it won't be God and Abraham to walk between the pieces together. Notice in verse 12, he puts Abraham into a deep sleep, but it is a visionary sleep because he's conscious what's happening around him. And then read in verse 17, it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a flaming torch that passed between these pieces. In that day, Jacob made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto your seed have I given this land from the river Egypt, the great river, the river Euphrates. Not Abraham and God together walked between the animals, but God alone in visible form, in the form of the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory, walks alone between the pieces of the animals. So by going through it alone, it renders the covenant unconditional. What it means is that no matter how often Abram fails, and in fact he will fail in the very next chapter, chapter 16, Abraham's failures cannot render the covenant null and void. And no matter how often his descendants fail, Israel's failures cannot render the covenant null and void. It is unconditional. The fifth passage is chapter 17, verses 1 through 21. Chapter 17, 1 through 21. Here the focus is on the token of the covenant. Now between chapter 15 and 17, 23 years pass. Between chapter 15 and 17, 23 years pass. He on one hand reaffirms certain promises he made previously, but now adds some new ones, such as, Abram will also be the father of many other nations, as well as fathering one nation in particular. But again, he emphasizes the land was given to both Abram and his descendants. This is verses 1 through 8. In verses 9 through 14, he provides the token of the covenant and not a circumcision. So the rainbow is the token of the Noahic covenant, and circumcision becomes the token of the Abrahamic covenant. In verses 15 through 21, he for the first time makes explicit that Sarah will be the mother of the covenant son. By now, Ishmael has already been born in chapter 16, but Hagar will not be the mother of the covenant son. God explicitly says it's going to be Sarah that'll be the mother of the covenant son. The sixth passage is chapter 22, verses 15 through 18. Chapter 22, verses 15 through 18. We have reaffirmation of the covenant after his test of offering up his son Isaac. And so verses 15 through 17, the promise of a national seed. And in verse 18, again, the promise of Gentile blessing for the seed of Abraham. So twice in this covenant, first time and last time, he promises Gentile blessing through this covenant, though the means won't be revealed till later. Now, point two in your outline, the persons involved are God and Abraham. We talked about the covenants last week. We mentioned that both Adam and Noah were the representatives of the population as a whole. They're the representative heads of the whole human race, but Abraham becomes the representative head not of the whole human race, but only of the Jewish people and Jewish nation. So a set of Abraham will be true of the nation as a whole. Now, point three, we come to the provisions. And from these six passages, we can draw a number of provisions. That the first three are the major ones. They are the ones most repeated. Others are also listed. Some are mentioned only once. But the first three are mentioned repeatedly. First of all, from Abram will come a great nation, one nation in particular, the Jewish nation, the nation of Israel. Secondly, to the nation, he promises a land, which in the Genesis is called the land of Canaan. Later it will be called the land of Israel. But as far as within Genesis, it's called the land of Canaan. Thirdly, Abraham will be blessed. And because this is unconditional, God blesses Abraham even when he is in the wrong. Genesis 12, for example, he lies about his wife, passes off as his sister, and so Pharaoh takes Sarah into his harem and gives Abraham the bride price of a great amount of wealth. When things are discovered, the wife goes back to Abram, but Pharaoh does not take the gifts away. Abraham leaves a wealthier man than when he came into Egypt. And God will bless him in spite of his failures. Fourthly, Abraham's name will be great. You look at the world religions that focus usually under one founder and nobody else. Abraham is honored by three world religions: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all to a lesser or greater degree, honor Abraham. Fifthly, Abraham will be a blessing to others. And those who come in contact with Abraham in a positive way end up being blessed by him, such as Lot and such as Melchizedek. Sixthly, those who bless him will be blessed. Those who bless him will be blessed, but the opposite is also true. Number seven is, those who curse him will be cursed. Those who curse him will be cursed. And what you see very consistent in all Jewish history, those who curse the Jews end up being cursed, but those that are blessed, the Jews end up being blessed, USA being one key example. The eighth provision is that in you all will be blessed. And again, there is a special promise of Gentile blessing. And again, that we'll come back to that issue in 2 weeks' time with the new covenant. Number nine, Sarah will produce a son, and that will be the covenant son. Number 10, there's the promise of the Egyptian bondage. They'll have a time of enslavement before they begin to own the land. The 11th provision is that the nations come from Abraham, and these other nations will be the Arab nations, the Arab tribes. And so all these Arab tribes, like the Bedouin tribes and Arab nations, are all coming from Abraham. The 12th provision is a change of name. So Abram or Avram goes to Abraham or Avraham. Now Abram, Avram means exalted father. Exalted father, but Avraham, Abraham, means the father of a multitude. The father of a multitude. Commemorating, he'll be the father of many nations. The 13th provision is that there'll be a change of his wife's name as well. In place of being called Sarai, meaning my princess, she'll be called Sarah, meaning the princess. A name a bit more exalted. A last provision, number 14, is the token of the covenant, which is circumcision. Now, circumcision did not originate with Abraham. It does not begin with the Jewish people. Other nations, other peoples, other tribes within Abraham's time period practiced circumcision. The uniqueness of Jewish circumcision is not on the act itself, but on the day it's performed, and that's the eighth day. Because in all other societies, the boy was either circumcised at the time of his birth or the time when he goes into puberty. The uniqueness of Jewish circumcision is that it happens on the eighth day of life. And because the Abrahamic covenant is a blood covenant, the shedding of blood with the circumcision, then it becomes an outward sign of Jewishness. And because Jewishness will be passed down by natural generation. Now, point four, the categorization of the provisions. Notice that some provisions are made to Abraham, some to Israel, and some to Gentiles. So to Abraham, for example, on one hand, he'll be the father of one specific nation, but also be the father of many other nations. He himself will possess the land. He will sire kings, both Jewish kings and non-Jewish kings. He's promised personal blessings. He's promised to be a blessing to others. His name will be great. The second category is provisions made specifically for Israel, the seed of Abraham. These include the fact the nation will become great and it will become innumerable. Someday his seed will also possess the land and have victory over the enemies. As for the Gentiles, there'll be blessings for blessing Israel and cursings for cursing Israel. But again, there's a promise made twice to Abraham that someday the spiritual blessings of the covenant will extend to the Gentiles. Now, the Hebrew word for seed is the word zera. And in classical Hebrew, the word is found only in the singular. In modern Hebrew, it appears in the plural. But in classical Hebrew, it appears only in the singular. And like in English, when you have a word that appears in the singular, it could refer to either an absolute singular or a collective singular. Like this word sheep. If there is one, I say one sheep. If there are two, I don't say two sheeps. I say two sheep, three sheep, four sheep. Because in English, that's a singular word in every case, and therefore, if I mean only one, that's an absolute singular. If I mean many, it is a collective singular. The same way the word zera is used. If it's used as an absolute singular, it refers to one specific descendant, the Messiah. And so the seed through which the Gentiles are blessed up is by means of the absolute singular seed, that would be the Messiah. If it's used as a collective singular, it refers to Israel. So it says your seed, singular, shall be as numerable as the sand of the sea, as the dust of the ground, as the stars of the heavens. That's a collective singular, a singular used for many, not just for one. So again, if it's used collectively, it refers to Israel. If it's used absolutely, it refers to the Messiah. Now, point five, three ramifications. The first ramification concerns the blessings. It's again important to note that the Abrahamic covenant contained both material blessings and spiritual blessings, but the material blessings are limited to Jews only. It's the spiritual blessings alone that are to extend to the Gentiles. The second ramification is a point we made in the introduction last week. Keep in mind that a covenant could be signed at a specific point of history, but this does not mean every provision goes immediately into effect. As we said, three different things happen. Some provisions go into effect right away, the day they're commanded, such as the change of name and the act of circumcision was immediate. But secondly, some provisions will come to pass only in the near future. So there was a 25-year wait before Isaac, the covenant son, was born. And there was a 4th century wait before the Egyptian bondage would end and the Exodus will occur and the conquest begins. But thirdly, some provisions go into effect only in the distant prophetic future, such as ownership of all the land, which has not taken place to this day. The third ramification has to do with seed, which I mentioned earlier. Again, it's always singular in the Hebrew, and therefore used in two senses. The absolute singular is the Messiah, collective singular is the people of Israel. Now, point six, the three basic motifs, and notice that I got the outline a bit off, so the land, seed, and blessings actually go below number six. Again, the three specific aspects to the covenant. And the first, and what you have, the first major aspect is the land. The land facet will be developed further by the land covenant. The Abrahamic covenant is the foundational covenant, and the land facet is developed by the land covenant. The seed aspect will be developed by the Davidic covenant, and the spiritual blessings will be developed by the new covenant. And those three covenants we'll look at in 2 weeks' time. So again, look at the Abrahamic covenant as being the foundational one, land, seed, and blessings. The land covenant will develop the land aspect, Davidic, the seed aspect, and the new covenant, the blessing aspect. Now, point seven on your outline here is the reconfirmations. Altogether, Abraham had a total of eight sons altogether. And God did not choose to confirm the covenant through all eight sons, only chose to confirm it through one son. Now look at Genesis 26. And the confirmation comes only through Isaac in chapter 26, verses 2 through 5 and verse 24. Genesis 26, verses 2 through 5 and verse 24. And he makes the promise that Isaac will be blessed. And what he said to Abraham, he says to Isaac, to you and to your seed I will give the land. Not the land was promised to Isaac as much as promised to Isaac's seed. And the seed is to be multiplied. And again he promises that someday Gentiles themselves will be blessed through the seed of Abraham and Isaac now. The covenant is then sustained only through one of Abraham's eight sons, Isaac. Now go to chapter 28. Isaac has two sons. Once again, God chose not to sustain the covenant through both sons, only through one son, and that's Jacob. And in chapter 28, verses 13 through 15, chapter 28, 13 through 15, the land is promised again both to Jacob and Jacob's seed. In verse 13 and verse 15, Jacob himself is on the land. The seed is to be multiplied, and once again, what he promised Abraham and Isaac, he promises Jacob, someday the Gentiles will be blessed through the seed of Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. God did choose to sustain the covenant through all 12 sons, and in chapter 49 of Genesis, all 12 sons are sustained, and that's why they fathered the 12 tribes of Israel that collectively make up the people of Israel, the nation of Israel. Now, as far as the basis for a dispensation, this covenant is the basis for the dispensation of promise. And the count of Abraham's faith was the promises of God was reckoned to him for righteousness. The point nine, present status. This is not conditional covenant. And while some facets and promises have been fulfilled, some have not. And this covenant is still very much in effect. It's still working its way out. Let's turn to some examples with beginning with Exodus chapter 2, Exodus chapter 2. Verse 23, Exodus chapter 2, verse 23. And it came to pass in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage. And they cried, and the cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob. And God saw the children of Israel and took knowledge of them. Now the word remember does not mean he had previously forgotten, but the word remember often means he will now act on the basis of a previous commitment. And so the Exodus, notice, comes on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant. So God now determined, in fulfilling his Abrahamic covenant, to bring Israel out of Egypt. So in chapters 3 and 4, you have the long account of the call of Moses. The key word to note is the word Hineni, which means, here am I. When God called Abraham, Abraham said, Hineni, here am I, send me. And when God called Jacob, Jacob also said, Hineni, here am I, send me. When God called Isaac, he said, Hineni, here am I, send me. When God called Moses, Moses also said, Hineni, here am I, send Aaron. Only when he realizes God's getting angry at him, he finally submits. So towards the end of chapter 24, he's moving towards the land of Egypt. But look what happens in chapter 4. Verse 24, chapter 4, verse 24. And it came to pass on the way to the lodging place that Jehovah met him and sought to kill him. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet, and she said, "Surely a bloody bridegroom are you to me?" So he let him alone, and she said, "A bloody bridegroom are you to me because of the circumcision." Now, this is an odd account because God spent all this time convincing Moses to go to Egypt and be Israel's deliverer from Egypt. And now Moses is finally heading to do just that and says the Lord sought to kill him. What's behind all this? The Abrahamic covenant. Because when God commanded the circumcision, he also decreed in Genesis 17 that those who do not circumcise are to be cut off from among the people. Now he married Zipporah. Zipporah was not a Jewish woman. She was a Midianite. The Midianites did not practice circumcision. When the first son was born, Moses did have that first son circumcised. Apparently she did not like what she saw. When the second son was born, she would not allow him to circumcise, and Moses failed to fulfill his headship and have the son circumcised. So he was living in disobedience to the Abrahamic covenant. Now in chapter 2, we're just told that God was going to rescue Israel on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant, but how can you use someone who's living in disobedience to that same covenant? So God strikes Moses with some kind of a plague that makes him immovable. He's too weak to do it himself, close to death. Zipporah knows what the situation is, so she takes the act with a flintstone, circumcises a second son. She does say she saves her husband's life, but she still does not like what she had to do. So she keeps calling him a bloody bridegroom. She was half Midianite and half British. But as a result, she was sent home. She failed to see all those miracles that God will do in Egypt. And only when Moses arrives at Mount Sinai does Jethro, the father of Zipporah, bring the wife of Moses back to him. Chapter 6, verses 2 through 8, is the basis for the Exodus. Chapter 32, 11 through 14, after the sin of the golden calf, and God threatens to wipe out Israel and begin a whole new nation with Moses. Moses says, "You cannot do that. It will violate the Abrahamic covenant. From Abraham, not Moses, the nation must come." And so God averted his wrath because of the Abrahamic covenant. Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 4 is the basis for giving Israel the land. 2 Kings chapter 13, verses 22 and 23, 2 Kings 13, 22 and 23, is the basis for Jewish survival in spite of many acts of disobedience. And the point is made that regardless of how heavily God will punish Israel, no matter how heavily he will discipline the Jewish people always survive as identifiable people because of the Abrahamic covenant. 1 Chronicles chapter 16, verses 15 through 19. 1 Chronicles 16, 15 through 19 is the basis for giving them the land. The same point is made in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 7 and 8. 2 Chronicles 20, verse 7 and 8. Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 7 and 8. Nehemiah 9, verse 7 and 8 is the basis for both the Exodus and the giving of the land. The same point is made in Psalm 105, verses 7 through 12. Psalm 105, verses 7 through 12. Luke chapter 1, verse 54 and 55. Luke 1, 54 and 55 is the basis for Messiah's coming. Luke chapter 1, verses 68 through 73, Luke 1, verse 68 through 73, is the basis for the future messianic redemption of Israel. Galatians 3, verses 15 through 18, Galatians 3, verses 15 through 18, where he parallels the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant, points out while the Mosaic covenant was temporary, the Abrahamic covenant is eternal. Hebrews 6, verses 13 through 20. Hebrews 6, 13 through 20 is the basis for the assurance of our salvation. because we are also part of an unconditional covenant, Abraham's failure could not render God's promises to him null and void. Our failures could not render God's promises to us null and void. Acts 26, verses 6 to 8. Acts 26, verses 6 to 8 is the basis for the resurrection of the dead. We'll see why in a minute. Leviticus chapter 26, verses 40 through 42. Leviticus 26, verse 40 through 42. Israel's final regathering for the Messianic kingdom is based upon the Abrahamic covenant as the basis of Israel's final millennial restoration. Let's look at one more passage, Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22. Now, verses 23 through 33, chapter 22, verses 23 through 33, you have the account of Jesus and the Sadducees. And as many of you know, if not all of you already know, there are many differences, key differences between Pharisees and Sadducees. There's some key distinctions between Pharisaic Judaism and Sadducean Judaism. One of the key differences is that the Pharisees did believe that when Messiah comes, there'll be resurrection of the dead. The Sadducees did not believe in any future resurrection of the dead. They had no resurrection hope. That's why they were sad, you see. And the Sadducees enjoyed asking the Pharisees tricky questions to make them look stupid and often succeeded. What happens here, they're trying to trick questions upon Jesus to try to make Jesus look silly. They come to Jesus and say, "No, we have a theological problem. Maybe you can solve it for us. Here's our problem. There was a couple that had seven sons. The other son married this one woman, but he dies with no children. So in keeping with the Mosaic law, the second son marries her. He too dies and no kids. Again, with the Mosaic law, the third brother marries her. He also dies with no kids. One by one, all seven brothers were married to the same woman. One by one, they all died with no children. Eventually, she also passed away. Now, here's our question. In the resurrection, which they did not believe in anyway, but never mind. In the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? All seven were married to her. Now, if the Sadducees had come to me with that question, my answer would have been a bit different than one Jesus chose to give. In my case, I would have simply called for a grand jury investigation to find out, why are these guys dying off so soon after they married this one woman? Who cares who she could be married to? The question is, why are they dead to begin with? But Jesus chose to ignore that facet of the problem. Notice what he does not do. He does not quote the three classic passages from the Old Testament that teaches resurrection. He does not quote Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, Daniel 12, 2. He does not quote Isaiah 26, verse 19, Isaiah 26, 19. He does not quote Job 19, verse 25 and 26, Job 19, verse 25 and 26. Three key passages that teach resurrection he does not quote is a very good reason for it. Another difference between Pharisees and Sadducees was this. The Pharisees believed you can derive doctrine from any part of the Hebrew Bible, whether it's the law, the prophets, or the writings. The Sadducees said, no, you cannot do that. Every doctrine must originate from the five books of Moses. So in Sadducean Judaism, you can use the prophets and the writings to illustrate doctrine, but the origin must come from the five books of Moses. They saw no mention of a resurrection in the five books of Moses, and therefore would not believe in it. So Jesus to quote Isaiah, Job, or Daniel, while that was authoritative for the Pharisees, would not be authoritative for the Sadducees. So what does he do? In verse 32, notice he quotes Exodus chapter 3, verse 6. Exodus 3, verse 6, where God says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and God of Jacob. And this was the biblical formula for the Abrahamic covenant. We've simplified our terminology. We simply say Abrahamic covenant, but in the Bible it's a sentence, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But where in the Abrahamic covenant, God promised the resurrection. I gave you a list of 14 provisions, but notice resurrection was not one of them, so where does it come from? It comes to a very simple observation, which is this. If God makes a promise to an individual, and that individual dies before the promise is fulfilled, God is obligated to raise the person back to life to fulfill the promise to him, because every promise of God must be fulfilled, and it must be fulfilled to one to whom the promise was made. Now that was the principle in the mind of Abraham when he was asked to offer up Isaac. That's what Hebrews 11 teaches us. According to Hebrews 11, Abraham knew that if he had to kill Isaac, God would raise him back to life. But how did Abraham know that? You read Genesis 22, God never tells him that. But by that point of time, Abraham's faith has matured. He knew that God will fulfill every promise he makes. And he'll fulfill the promise to the person he made the promise to. And by that point of time, he made certain promises about Isaac which had not yet been fulfilled, like Isaac having a seed. Therefore, Abraham knew if he killed Isaac, God was obligated to raise Isaac back to life to fulfill the promise. So emphasized that God promised the land not only to the descendants of the patriarchs, but to all three men. He said, to you and to your seed, I will give this land. By the time they died, what did they own of the land? Abraham owned one burial cave, he had to pay a very highly inflated price for him, and somewhere else. And Jacob had to purchase a land, a plot of land outside of Shechem. That's all they held in real estate holdings. And all that without owning the land. So how is God going to keep his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? He must raise them back to life and give them the land. So contained within the unfulfilled promises God makes to individuals is the promise of resurrection. And so twice in Matthew chapter 8, verse 11 and 12, Matthew 8, 11 and 12, and Luke chapter 13, verse 29 and 30, Luke 13, 29 and 30, God says the Messianic kingdom, people come from the north, south, east, and west, and they will sup, they will fellowship with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They'll be resurrected, they will live in the promised land, and they'll finally get to own the land as God promised. So past, present, and future, this covenant is still working its way out in God's plan and program. All right, any questions on the Abrahamic covenant? Yes?
What was the distinction again you made between the Wadi Al-Arish and River of Egypt? Borders the land, go to the Wadi Al-Arish?
Wadi Al-Arish is the brook of Egypt. And that's as far south as the Jewish people will settle in the kingdom. That's the limit of settlement. As far as limit of control, they'll control northern Sinai all the way towards now the Suez Canal. He'll end the land in the millennium, the Messianic kingdom. He didn't own it before, he doesn't own it now, he won't own it until he's resurrected.
But those who populate the earth during the millennium will come from the tribulation, right? The believing saints.
Those who survive the tribulation as believers will go into the millennium. And the millennium will be made up of two types of people, living people who survive the tribulation and resurrected saints. So the resurrected saints, and there'll be living saints. So if we die and we're raised to the rapture, we'll be in the kingdom as well. But as the church will be around the world, Israel will be within the land. Yes?
God promised to make Abraham's descendants as numerous as the sand in the sea and the stars in the sky. Is there a difference between them?
Well, the difference people try to make of it is that the sand of the sea is his earthly seed and the stars of the heavens is his heavenly seed. But does it just means the same things, referring to his physical descendants? It doesn't refer to the church.
It doesn't mean Gentiles.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
No, well, just to piggyback on what you're saying,
This is a Jewish school. We don't piggyback.
Oh, yeah. I'll post your back.
Okay. Okay. You can go beef backing.
I take it God was just talking about the number, the quantity.
Right.
He was talking about the sand and the sea and the stars.
Right. So that they'll be innumerable, which hasn't happened so far, but it will happen in the kingdom.
Okay.
Question?
Actually, I have.
Okay.
Under reconfirmations.
Which passage you mean?
Yes.
Well, for Isaac, it's chapter 26 of Genesis, verses 2 through 5 and verse 24. And for Jacob, it's chapter 28, verses 15 through 17. Question about the Abrahamic covenant. All right, take your break, and we'll pick it up with the Mosaic. We'll break until about 12 after. Now, second covenant we'll be dealing with is the Mosaic covenant. Again, I've changed the outline a bit to be a bit more detailed. So point one, as far as scripture, it's a long segment. It begins in the book of Exodus, chapter 20, verse 1. Exodus 20, verse 1, all the way through the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 28 and verse 68. Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 68. So what it does, it includes the last 21 chapters of Exodus, all of Leviticus, all of Numbers, and the first 28 chapters of Deuteronomy. So if there are no objections, I'm going to skip the reading of this covenant. But as far as point two, persons, the persons are God and Israel. And look at Exodus chapter 19. Look at Exodus chapter 19, verses 3 through 8. Verses 3 through 8, verse 3 says, "And Moses went up unto God, and Jehovah called him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shall you say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, how I bore your eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. You shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak unto the children of Israel. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people and set before them all these words which Jehovah commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, All that Jehovah hath spoken we will do. And Moses reported the words of the people unto Jehovah." Now, note he specifically mentions that he makes this covenant specifically with the same people he brought out of Egypt. The covenant is not made with the Gentiles, it's not made with the church. It's made strictly with the people of Israel. And that point is repeated many times. We'll look at three other examples. But the first one, go to Deuteronomy chapter 4, the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 7, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 7. "For what great nation is there that had a God so nigh unto them as Jehovah our God is whensoever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that statutes and ordinances so righteous as all this law which I set before you this day?" And this he specifies, no other nation has been given these rules and regulations. And so while the Gentiles still continue under the Adamic and Noahic covenants, the Jewish people now have to rule, live under the Mosaic covenant given only for Israel. Second example is Psalm 147. Psalm 147. Verse Samaja 47, verse 19 and 20, Psalm 147, verse 19, He shows His word unto Jacob, His statutes and His ordinances unto Israel. Then notice, He has not dealt so with any other nation. As for His ordinances, they have not known them. Praise ye Jehovah. And what makes Israel unique, he points out, is only Israel was given the whole Mosaic law. The third example is Malachi chapter 4. Malachi chapter 4, verse 4, Malachi 4, 4. Verse 4, Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, even statutes and ordinances. It's very important to avoid the confusion the church is often in nowadays that the Mosaic law was given strictly to the people of Israel. This covenant is not made with Gentiles, it's not made with the church. And the content of the Mosaic covenant is the Mosaic law. And this covenant was sealed also by the Shekinah glory. In the book of Exodus chapter 24, verses 1 through 11, chapter 24, 1 through 11, but sealed in such a way that renders this covenant conditional. It's not signed in the same way as the Abrahamic, which was unconditional, but signed in a manner which renders the covenant conditional. But also by means of the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory. The point three, provisions. Now, because it contains a total of 613 commandments, there are 613 provisions. 613 provisions. If you're ready, first, I won't do that to you. If you want a list of all the 613 commandments, you can do two things. Number one, you can simply call REL Ministries and talk to my secretary, Denise, and ask for a copy, and she can mail it to you or fax it to you. I believe in the library here you have the Encyclopedia Judaica. If you look in the section called Commandments, you'll have the list of all 613 in that volume. So you can get either way. But it's important, remember, the Law of Moses does not contain 10 commandments. That's not the totality, contains 613 commandments total. Of these 613, 365 were negative commandments, things you must not do. 365 negative. Also, it had 248 positive commandments, 248 positive ones, things you had to do. So in place of listing all of the provisions, I'll give you seven observations. The first one again, the 613, 265 negative, 248 positive. A second thing to note about the provisions is that this is a conditional covenant, and so there are blessings for obedience, but there is discipline, judgment for disobedience. Exodus 15, verse 26, Exodus chapter 15, verse 26, and chapter 19, verses 3 through 8, chapter 19, verses 3 through 8. A third thing about the provisions, the key element is the blood sacrifice. Now, obviously, there was already blood sacrifice before the Mosaic law. There was already blood sacrifice from the day they were expelled from the garden. But the Mosaic covenant, the blood sacrifices receive a tremendous elaboration. Now turn to Leviticus chapter 17 and note the importance of it. Leviticus chapter 17. And verse 11. Leviticus 17, verse 11. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I've given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement by reason of the life. And in God's government, he chose to make blood the means of atonement. So in chapters 1 through 7, the first seven chapters of this book talks about the five different types of offerings. Now, four of these five were blood offerings. Only one was not blood, that was the meal offering, but even the meal offering was never offered apart from blood. Because every morning, the first thing they did was offer up a burnt offering, which was a blood offering, and the meal offering was offered up with the blood atonement of the burnt offering. Now, Hebrews chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, Hebrews 10, verses 1 through 4 points out, animal blood could never take away sin. And in fact, the Hebrew word for atonement, kippur, K-I-P-P-U-R, K-I-P-P-U-R, means covering. The sins were covered, but they were not removed. Because Hebrews 10, verses 1 through 4 teaches it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. And that was true even before the cross. And that's why when Messiah died, he didn't only die for the sins committed after his death, he had to die for the sins committed before his death. And Hebrews makes the point in Hebrews 9, verse 15, Hebrews 9, 15. And Paul makes it in Romans 3, verse 25, Romans 3, 25. Now, the animal blood did provide for the forgiveness of sin. It did provide for restoration of fellowship. But it could not cleanse the conscience of the Old Testament saint. He walked there with a consciousness of his sin, and he knew he would have to repeat the blood sacrifice again in the future. Well, only Messiah's blood is the cleansing of the conscience. Now, a fourth observation about these provisions is for the Jewish people, it restricted some of the provisions of the Noahic Covenant. It restricted some of the provisions in the Noahic Covenant. For example, land animals. While the Noahic Covenant, as we saw last week, said any moving thing shall be food for you, there are no limitations as to what they could eat. Now things become limited for the Jewish people. And for land animals, the animals had to be both cloven-hoofed and chewed the cud. That they be both cloven-hoofed and chewed the cud for them to be edible. As far as fish, all fish had to have fins and scales, both fins and scales, and therefore no shrimp, no lobster, no crab. As far as fowls, no birds of prey were allowed. As far as insects, only one type of locust was allowed. Now, when Moses said I could have this one type of locust, I'd never yet been tempted to partake. Now, tell it not in Gath and publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, but just between you and me, I'd much rather have a ham on rye than a locust on a bagel. Now, fifth thing to observe is that for the Jewish people, added the death penalty for many other sins. Now, again, the Noahic Covenant only required the death penalty for premeditated murder. For the Mosaic Covenant, for the Jewish people, other sins required the death penalty, such as adultery, idolatry, cursing God, cursing parents, breaking the Sabbath, any form of witchcraft, not called practices. That's only a short list. Now, sixth observation concerns circumcision. As we saw in the first hour tonight, circumcision was part of the Abrahamic covenant. It was a sign of the covenant, a token of the covenant, and mandatory for Jews only. But now circumcision is also required by the Mosaic covenant, but it's not merely a sign of Jewishness, but the means of submission to the Mosaic law, the means of submission to the law of Moses. Leviticus chapter 12, verse 3, Leviticus 12, 3. And that's why Paul warns the Galatians The Gentile Galatians, if they submit to circumcision, they'll be obligated to keep the whole law, not just that one commandment. So the Abrahamic covenant, circumcision was for Jews only, but for the Mosaic covenant, mandatory for Jews and for those Gentiles who wish to become part of the Commonwealth of Israel. Gentiles did not need to be circumcised to be saved, but if they wished to receive the benefits of the Jewish covenants, they would need to be circumcised. The seventh observation concerns the Sabbath. Let me mention five things about the Sabbath, because history has a lot of confusion. First of all, the Sabbath becomes the token of the Mosaic Covenant. And since it becomes the token of the Mosaic Covenant, it's only relevant for Israel. And every reason the Bible gives for observing the Sabbath only has relevance to Israel. For example, the book of Exodus, chapter 31, verses 12 through 17, Exodus 31, 12 through 17, the Sabbath is a sign that Israel as a nation has been set apart by God. Only Israel is a nation set apart by God. The book of Deuteronomy, chapter 5, verses 12 through 15, Deuteronomy 5, 12 through 15, is a sign of the Exodus, a sign that God brought Israel out of Egypt, and he did not bring the Seventh-day Adventist church out of Egypt. Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 12, Ezekiel 20, verse 12, it's a sign of Israel setting apart, and it's a memorial of the Exodus. Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 20, Ezekiel 20, 20. It's a sign that Jehovah alone is Israel's God. The Sabbath is a token specifically of the Mosaic covenant and therefore is relevant only for Israel. Now, second thing to note is this. The Sabbath is not a creation ordinance. It began with Moses. What we mean by creation ordinance is that it's a command given at the time of creation. And well, commandments were given at the time of creation. And we saw commandments last week in the Edenic covenant, the Adamic covenant, the Noahic covenant. There's no command to keep the Sabbath. And the seventh day, notice, was not called the Sabbath anywhere in Genesis. It's simply called the seventh day, but not called Shabbat, not called the Sabbath. And that's why from Adam to Moses, there is no record of anybody keeping the Sabbath. The book of Job is a great book because Job is a pre-Mosaic saint. He mentions many of the events of Genesis, like the creation and the flood. And he lists many of man's obligations to God, but keeping the Sabbath is never one of them. The Sabbath only began with Moses. The first commandment is given in the book of Exodus 16, verses 23 to 30, Exodus 16, 23 through 30. It was then incorporated into the Ten Commandments in chapter 20, verses 8 through 11, chapter 20, 8 through 11. Now my third point is also a common misconception, which is this. The Sabbath was not a day of corporate worship. It was a day of rest. Nowhere in the Mosaic law did God ever tell Moses, or Moses tell the Jewish people, to gather together every Sabbath for corporate worship. He never says that. The only ones commanded for gathering corporately is the priesthood for the purpose of offering the special blood sacrifices for the Sabbath. On the Sabbath day, all blood sacrifices were doubled. For the rest of Israel, they were simply to stay home and rest and not travel more than a Sabbath day's journey, which is the equivalent to a modern-day kilometer. And this is where the Seventh-day Adventist person makes a major mistake. Because he gets up Saturday morning and goes to his car and starts the engine and drives to his church. In his mind, he's keeping the Sabbath biblically. Week after week, he keeps breaking the Sabbath. He's not staying home and resting. He's kindling an engine. Now keep in mind, the Mosaic law, corporate worship was only allowed where the tabernacle and temple stand, first Shiloh, then Jerusalem. If you lived in Jerusalem, it would be possible to have corporate worship every Sabbath, but suppose you lived up in the Galilee, which was a 3-day journey each way. Now pity the Galilean Jew who had to have corporate worship every Sabbath. He would spend 3 days walking up to Jerusalem. He would then have corporate worship on the Sabbath day, then walk 3 days back down to Galilee. When he finally got home, he would then kiss his wife hello, but then kiss her goodbye and make a U-turn to get back to Jerusalem in time for next Sabbath. He wouldn't be working for 6 days, he'd be walking for 6 days. So corporate worship in the Mosaic law was required only 3 times a year. The Feast of Passover, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles. Passover, Weeks, and Tabernacles. But the Sabbath was not a day of corporate worship, it was a day of rest. Now fourthly, the Sabbath was intended only for Israel and not for the church. The Sabbath was intended only for Israel and not for the church. There is no special day for the church. The church is free to meet anytime it chooses to meet. Now this church here meets on Sunday morning, a valid option. In the ministries Ariel has started, congregations, there's one that meets Friday night, one that meets Saturday morning, one meets even Sunday morning. There's a congregation I speak to regularly in Jerusalem when I'm there, they meet only Wednesday nights. All are equal options. So the elders of your church someday get together and decide from now on you'll meet only on Tuesdays to become Third-day Adventists. It's legitimate. Now the church must meet, but the day of the week is purely optional. The fifth thing to note is this. As a sign of the Mosaic Covenant, it's only in force as long as the covenant is in force. As a sign of the Mosaic Covenant, the Sabbath is in force only as long as the covenant is in force. If the covenant comes to an end, so does Sabbath observance. We'll come back to that a bit later. Now, point four, which again, I didn't get the right order in, and we already talked about this anyway, number four, issue of the previous covenants. As far as the Noahic covenant, again, the two areas we mentioned include different diet restrictions and increasing penalties for death. As for the Abrahamic covenant, Abrahamic covenant is eternal, but the Mosaic is temporary. And circumcision in the Abrahamic was for Jews only in the sign of the covenant. And but for the Mosaic, it's mandatory for Jews and Gentiles. And the means of submission to the law. All right, let's do number five, the purposes of the covenant. I've divided that into four categories. The first category is relationship to God. There's one key purpose here, and that is to reveal the holiness of God and the standard of righteousness which he required. To reveal the holiness of God and the standard of righteousness which he required. Leviticus 19, verse 1 and 2. Leviticus 19, verse 1 and 2, and then verse 37. Verse 37, also 1 Peter 1, verses 15 and 16. 1 Peter 1, 15 and 16. In Romans chapter 7, verse 12, Romans 7, verse 12, Paul says, the law was holy, righteous, and good. There was never a problem with the law. The problem was always with those with whom the law had to work with or work through. Now, small b, relationship to Israel, three purposes in connection with Israel. Now, first and foremost, to keep the Jews a distinct people. To keep the Jews a distinct people. To be different in all areas of their lives. Leviticus 11, verse 44 and 45. Leviticus 11, 44 and 45, Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 6, Deuteronomy 7, 6, and chapter 14, verse 1 and 2, chapter 14, verse 1 and 2. And many of the 613 commandments had no other purpose than this one, to keep the Jews a distinct people. That's, by the way, a major reason for the dietary code. Now pick up almost any book today that talks about the Mosaic dietary code. The whole emphasis is, God gave these laws to keep you healthy. And one thing I want to emphasize in this course on how to study the Bible is, where is it written? Not once does Moses ever say, you have to eat this way to keep healthy. But you have to eat this way to be distinct. If the issue was health, the prohibitions would have been from the very beginning. Because what did God tell the Gentiles? Every moving thing shall be food for you. For the Jews, this you can eat, this you cannot eat. And if the issue is health, we have to conclude God wants Gentiles sick and Jews healthy. He tells the church, all food is clean. And they conclude God wants the church sick, but the Jews healthy. Obviously, it's not the purpose. Regardless of what science has found, it's also true that some of the permitted food is not healthy, like sugar. And some of the things that are not permitted are not that bad for you. What about the clothing laws? Jews could not wear clothing made of mixed threads. There's nothing unhealthy about mixed threads, but Jews had to be different. Furthermore, there had to be tassels on the corners of the garments. Tassels of white with one tassel of blue. Nothing healthy about tassels, white and blue. But Jews had to be different. There are beard laws. Jews could not shave. So Jews had to have beards. And furthermore, the beards could not be rounded. They had to be squared. If you look at Orthodox Jews, they have squared beards. There's nothing unhealthy about shaving, but Jews have to be different. Nothing healthy about squared beards, but Jews have to be different. A second reason for Israel is to provide a rule of life for the Old Testament saint. It was never given as a means of salvation. The law was never given as a means of earning salvation. Romans 3, verse 20. Romans 3, verse 20, Galatians chapter 2, verse 16, Galatians 2, verse 16, Galatians 3, 11 and 21, Galatians 3, 11 and 21. It was given as a rule of life. How was a Jew saved? He was saved when he put his faith in the God of Israel, recognized him to be the only God and the only Savior. And once he was saved, then the question is, well, how do I now live? And the answer is, you live by the means of the Mosaic Law. That's your rule of life. And if you fail, there's a blood sacrifice to cover your sin. It was rule of life. Leviticus 11, 44 and 45. Leviticus 11, 44 and 45. Chapter 19, verse 2, 19, 2. Chapter 20, verses 7, 8, and 26. Chapter 20, 7, 8, and 26. And Romans 3, verse 28. Romans 3, verse 28. And the third purpose to Israel is to provide opportunities for both corporate and individual worship. Providing opportunities for both individual and corporate worship. Leviticus 23, for example, Leviticus 23, the seven holy seasons of Israel, three of those were for corporate worship, four of those were for individual worship. Now, small c, in connection with the Gentiles, there's one key purpose found in Ephesians 2, 11 through 16, Ephesians 2, 11 through 16. And that is to provide, to serve as a middle wall of partition to keep Gentiles away from enjoying the Jewish covenants. To serve as a middle wall of partition to keep Gentiles away from enjoying the spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants. And that's why, because of this middle wall of partition, Gentiles were two things in connection with the covenants. Number one, they were strangers to the covenants. And number two, they were far off, too far away to enjoy the covenants. If a Gentile wished to benefit, he would have to undergo conversion to Mosaic Judaism, undergo circumcision, take upon himself the obligations of the law, live like any Jew had to live under law. Gentiles as proselytes to Mosaic Judaism could benefit, but not Gentiles as Gentiles. The law kept them away. Now, small d connection with sin, turn now to Romans 7. Romans 7. The whole context involves Romans chapter 7, verse 7 through chapter 8, verse 4. Romans 7, 7 through chapter 8, verse 4. The four purposes in connection with sin. The first purpose is to show clearly what sin is. To show what sin is. Romans 3, verse 19 and 20. Romans 3, verse 19 and 20. Galatians 3, verse 19. Galatians 3, 19. And here in Romans 7, 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Howbeit, I have not known sin except through the law. Had not known coveting except the Lord has said, you shall not covet. And what he's saying is, he would not have known that coveting is a sin until he read in the law. The law told him, coveting is a sin. It gave him a knowledge of what sin is. But the second purpose is to cause one to sin even more. To cause one to sin even more. Romans 4, verse 15. Romans 4, 15. Romans 5, verse 20. Romans 5, verse 20. Here in chapter 7, in verses 8 to 11, he confesses that once he realized coveting was a sin, he tried to stop coveting. But the more he tried to stop coveting, he found himself coveting even more. He was coveting more after he realized it was a sin than before he realized it was a sin. Now, why did that happen? Keep your finger here and just turn for a moment to 1 Corinthians 15. Keep your finger in Romans and just turn to 1 Corinthians 15. And look at verse 56. 15, 56. The sting of death is sin, but the power of sin is the law. Notice the phrase, the power of sin is the law. And the point is, the sin nature, which we still have, uses the law, needs a base of operation. They use the law as a base of operation. So the law says, you shall not. The sin nature says, oh, yes, I will. The law says, you shall. The sin nature says, oh, no, I won't. And now the sin nature is something to work against. Ends up causing us to sin even more, as Paul's experience shows. That is the third purpose of the law found in verses 12 through 25. 12 through 25, to show that one could do nothing on his own to please God. There's no way he'll learn his salvation by keeping the law. He won't be able to earn his salvation. He could do nothing to please God. And once he realized that, then comes the fourth purpose of the law, to drive him to faith. To drive him to faith. Romans 8, verses 1 through 4. Romans 8, 1 through 4. Galatians 3, verse 24 and 25. Galatians 3, verse 24 and 25. So once he realized that he could not please God and put his faith in God, receive salvation, and he learned the proper purpose of the law was not a means of earning salvation, but rule of life for those already saved. Now, point six, the basis for a dispensation. This becomes the basis of dispensation of the law. The law was given through Moses. Obviously, there were commandments given before Moses, but there was a new display of divine law with Moses. And the previous covenants did not carry the amount of law that the Mosaic law contains. And the last thing for tonight, the present status. What the New Testament teaches is the Mosaic Law was a conditional covenant, broken several times, but finally came to an end with Messiah's death. Now the background to this is James chapter 2 verse 10, James 2:10, that teaches to break only one commandment is to break the whole law. To break even one commandment makes you guilty of breaking the whole law. What's happened in the course of church history is that they've tried to divide the law in different parts and saying, well, one, this part is gone, but this part we still have to keep. And some make a two-division view. The two-division view says the Ten Commandments we still must keep, but not the other 603. So 603 are not done away with, but Ten Commandments we still have to keep. And the majority of the people who say we still have to must keep the Ten Commandments mean Nine Commandments. They always fudge on the Sabbath issue. They really fudge on that one. Well, we go to church on Sunday. Well, Sunday is never called a Sabbath. And if you're traveling on that day, you're not keeping the Sabbath anyway. And even Seventh-day Adventists who claim to keep all ten, when they drive to church on the Sabbath, they end up breaking it, not keeping it. So even those who say 10 generally mean 9. Others have a three-division stage in which they say, well, the law has three parts, ceremonial, civil, and moral. Ceremonial, civil, and moral. We are no longer under ceremonial law or civil law. We must keep the moral law. But as you read the material, they disagree among themselves as to what elements constitute the moral law. But the Bible does not allow us to divide the law into divisions, two or three, some in, some out. These are 613 commandments, not 613 suggestions. And the teaching is that when Messiah died, the whole Mosaic law, all 613, including people's favorite 10, meaning 9, has come to an end. Now look at me, with me with several passages. Let's go back to Romans 7. Look at verse 5. Romans 7, verse 5. For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were through the law wrought in our members to bring forth fruit unto death. But now we have been discharged from the law, having died to die when we were held, so we serve in newness of spirit, not in oldness of the letter. And notice we've been discharged from the law. That we refer specifically to Jewish believers, been discharged from the law. Now look at chapter 10, verse 4, Romans 10, verse 4. Here he writes, for Christ is the end of the law unto righteousness to everyone that believes. Notice the word end. Now the Greek word uses here is the word telos. And while some try to claim that telos means goal, it does have the possible meaning of goal, but in the lexicons, it's listed as the third or fourth in preference. The primary meaning of telos is always termination. Not goal, but termination. It's the termination of the law. And in keeping the context of Romans, in Romans 7, he's already told us we've been discharged from the law. So it's not goal, but termination. Now go to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians 3, verses 15 through 19. Galatians 3, verses 15 through 19. In verses 15 through 18, he says the law was an addition to the Abrahamic covenant. That's the word added. Brethren, I speak after the manner of men, though it had to be a man's covenant, yet when it had been confirmed, no one makes a void, as thereto, not Abraham, where the promise is spoken to a seed. And the Mosaic Law was an addition to the Abrahamic Covenant. And being an addition, it cannot replace the Abrahamic Covenant, only could add to it, but not replace it. Now, why did God add the Mosaic Law? Look at verse 19. What then is the law? It was added because of transgressions, again, to make sin very clear. But for how long? Until the seed should come to the promise was made. Now, what seed is he talking about? Here he told us in verse 16, the seed is the absolute singular seed, the Messiah. Afterwards, the law was given only temporarily until the seed should come, and now the seed has come. And therefore, the law is ended. Next section, which is Galatians 3, verse 23 through chapter 4, verse 7. Galatians 3, verse 23 to chapter 4, verse 7. Now look at verse 23. But before faith came, we were kept in ward under law, shut up unto faith which should afterwards be revealed, so that the law is become our tutor to bring us unto Christ, who might be justified by faith. So what is the law? It's the tutor. The tutor is the law. But now look at verse 25. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under the tutor. The tutor is the law, but now that we have faith, we are no longer under the tutor. The law has ceased to be our rule of life. Let's skip down to chapter 4, verse 4. Chapter 4, verse 4. When the fullness of the time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, and he came for the benefit of two groups in verse 5, that he might redeem them, the third person pronoun, them, under the law, that's the Jewish people, and that we, first person pronoun, we Jews and Gentiles who believe, might receive the adoption of sons. And so the major purpose of Messiah's come was to redeem the Jewish people from being under the law. Now go to Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 11. Ephesians 2, verse 11. But remember that once ye the Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision, by which is called circumcision in the flesh made by hands, you at that time separate from Christ, and live in the commonwealth of Israel, from the commonwealth of the promise, have no hope without God in the world, but now in Christ Jesus, ye that once far off, are made none in the blood of Christ, for he is our peace, who made both one, and broke down the middle wall of partition, having abolished in his flesh the enmity of the law of commandments contained in ordinances. And that's what he calls the middle partition in verse 14, he defines as being the law of commandments and ordinances. That's what the law was. The middle partition to give Gentiles a way from enjoying the blessings of the Jewish covenants. But now the middle wall of partition has been broken down. It's now Gentiles get to partake of the spiritual promises. Look at chapter 3, verse 6. Chapter 3, verse 6, the Gentiles are fellow heirs, fellow members of the body, fellow partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the gospel. The middle wall has been broken down. Now look at Hebrews 7. Hebrews 7. The context is verses 11 through 18. And verse 11 says, now if there was perfection in the Levitical priesthood, under it had the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise in the order of Melchizedek and not be reckoned the order of Aaron? For the priesthood being changed, there was made of necessity a change also of the law. Which taught us so far as this, there is an inseparable connection between the Mosaic law and Levitical priesthood. One cannot function apart from the other. The basis of the Levitical priesthood is the law. Much of the law can only function through the same Levitical priesthood. So Psalm 110, verse 4, prophesies of a future priest coming after Melchizedek, the order of Melchizedek, require a change of the law. As long as the Mosaic law is in force, it will not allow a Melchizedekian priesthood to function, only Levitical priesthood to function. So verse 13, it presents the problem. For he of whom these things are said belongs to another tribe, from which no man hath given unto the altar. It is evident that our Lord has sprung out of Judah, as to which tribe Moses said nothing concerning priests. In other words, Jesus simply did not qualify to be a Levitical priest. He was of the wrong tribe. He was Judean, not Levitical. So Jesus, the function of the order of Melchizedek, as he pointed out in verse 12, needs to be a change of the law. Now look at verse 18. For there is a disannulling of the foregoing commandment because of his own weakness, because weakness and unprofitableness. The law made nothing perfect. The law has been disannulled, and that's why he could function as our high priest in heaven. The law has ceased to be a rule of life. Now look at chapter 8, verse 13. Chapter 8, verse 13. After quoting the new covenant of Jeremiah in verses 8 through 12, he says in verse 13, in that he said a new covenant, he made the first one old. But that which is becoming old waxes age, is nigh unto vanishing away. He points out that as soon as Jeremiah said new covenant, he rendered the old one, the Mosaic one, the old one. If I told you that I now have a new car, it makes my other car the old one. It may only be 3 or 4 months old, but that's my old car. As the Mosaic law became old under Jeremiah, it vanished away when Messiah died. It became old under Jeremiah, it vanished away when Messiah died. One more passage, 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Second Corinthians 3, verses 2 through 11. It's a very good passage because it focuses on that part of the law people want to hang on to, the Ten Commandments, meaning nine. Because in verse 3, he specifies he's talking about those engraven upon stone, and that would be the Ten Commandments. What about the Ten Commandments of the Mosaic Law? He calls them two things in verse 7. Administration of death, and in verse 9, administration of condemnation. Verse 7, administration of death. Verse 9, administration of condemnation. If they're still enforced today, that's what they would be. But then twice in verse 7 and again in verse 11, 7:11 uses the Greek word which is katargeo, and the Greek word that means to render inoperative, to render inoperative. The whole Mosaic law was rendered inoperative with Messiah's death. It ceased to be a rule of life. And in verses 7 through 11, verse 7 through 11, he goes on to teach the superiority of the law of the Messiah is it will not undergo katagero, will not be rendered inoperative. So again, the basic teaching of Scripture is that the Mosaic law was enforced till Messiah died. And once he died, it ceased to be a rule of life. So today, we are now under a, not under law, but under grace, Paul writes three times. Romans 6, verse 14. Romans 6, 14. Romans 7, verse 4 and 6. Romans 7, verse 4 and 6. Galatians 5, verse 18. Galatians 5, verse 18. Does that mean that we can now kill and steal and commit adultery? No, we still cannot do those things, not because of the law of Moses, because of the law of the Messiah. And we'll discuss that law when we discuss the new covenant next time. But that law is mentioned in Romans 8, verse 2, Romans 8, verse 2, Galatians chapter 6, verse 2, Galatians 6, verse 2. And so we discuss the new covenant, we'll discuss the law of the Messiah, and then we'll see what our rule of life is today. But let me conclude with what all this means in practical life today. The fact that the law comes to an end when Messiah died means we are free from any obligation to obey any of the 613 commandments of Moses. We do not have that obligation today. Leave some loose ends, like can we kill and so on, but again we'll tie those loose ends together next time. But freedom from the law means two things. We're free from the need to obey. We're also free to obey those commandments which are New Testament neutral. They do not violate any New Testament imperative. So if people want to follow the dietary law, they're free to do so. They wish to keep the Sabbath, they're free to do so. They wish to wear clothing of regular threads, not mixed threads, they're free to do so. They have tassels, they're free to do so. They want to observe Passover, they're free to do so. But many commandments are not New Testament neutral. For example, the Mosaic law said you cannot invite a Gentile to your table unless you first make sure he's circumcised first. Well, thank God I don't have to check that thing anymore. With the law, I would have to check that out, but not now. And now I can invite Gentiles to my table and not worry about it. So there's a freedom to participate as long as certain things are clear. Number one, there's no value in justification. Never was and never will be. But secondly, while at one time there was possible to be sanctified through law, now there is no value in sanctification, in keeping the law. We're now sanctified by Messianic law, not Mosaic law. There's no merit before God. There's no special spirituality in the Messianic movement. Half the same, it does not increase your Jewishness. It doesn't make you more Jewish. We must avoid the temptation to stand before the mirror in the morning and say, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the most Jewish of us all? Now keep in mind, next week Bob will be teaching on something relevant to the course we've been taking. So he'll be teaching the course next week, and then 2 weeks from now we'll conclude the course with the last three covenants. Our time is actually up. I'll give you about 2 or 3 or 4 minutes for questions before I give you my rabbi story. Any questions about the Mosaic Covenant? Okay, I'm going to give you 3 rabbi stories. I'll give you 4 or 5 2 weeks from now to give them all. The first two have come from Russia, one from the time of the Tsars and one from the time of the Communists. Now, during the Tsarist period, the Russian army was rather quite anti-Semitic, which is the background to the story. If you look at Jewish history books, you'll know that the Russian army will sometimes invade Jewish villages, take all the Jewish boys from about the age of 10, both below and older than that, and younger than that, and force them to serve in the Russian army for 30 years before ever coming to visit home. And the story is of a Russian rabbi sitting in a train in one of these cubicles that would seat 68 people. He's there all by himself because nobody else wanted to sit in the same cabin as a Jew sat. And suddenly the door swings open and there stands the Russian officer in his military regalia. He sees the rabbi, would not want to sit with him, slams the door shut and walks away, trying to find another place to sit, but all the other seats were taken. So he had the option to simply stand for the whole train trip, which was many hours long, or sit where the rabbi sits, so that's what he chose to do. And the seats were facing each other, so here the rabbi was sitting here reading his stuff, and the Russian officer was sitting this way, facing the rabbi, giving him dirty looks, scowling at him, making faces at him, but the rabbi learned to ignore those things years ago. But then suddenly the officer spoke up and said, "What makes you Jews so smart?" Rabbi said, "I beg your pardon." Well, the man says, "Well, we Russian officers were discussing this, and we noticed that the Jews are smarter than the Russians. Now, what makes you Jews so smart?" Rabbi says, "The reason we're smart is we eat herring 3 times a day. And the man says, "Eating that herring makes you smart?" "Yes," said the rabbi. "We eat herring 3 times a day. In fact, I have a jar of herring with me. I'll have for lunch so I can stay smart." The officer said, "Well, will you sell me that jar of herring?" And the rabbi said, "Yes, you can have this for 25 rubles. The officer gave him 25 rubles, and the rabbi gave him the jar of herring, which the officer finished rather quickly. When he was finished, the officer said, "You know, in Moscow, I could have gotten the same amount of herring for only 5 rubles. The rabbi said, "See, you're smarter already." The second comes in the time of communism. The synagogues were largely all closed except for the showpiece they had in Moscow. Weren't that many rabbis around, but the ones who were around were often followed by agents of the KGB. This one agent was assigned to this one rabbi who noticed every morning the rabbi would come out to Gorky Park and open up some strange writings which did not, the officer did not recognize, began memorizing the stuff. After a while, he got very curious. Maybe this is some secret documents that the people in the Kremlin should know about. The agent approached the rabbi and said, "What's the strange writing that you seem to be memorizing?" The rabbi said, "Well, this is simply modern Hebrew. I'm trying to learn how to speak modern Hebrew." The agent says, "Rabbi, you're an old man. Why are you trying to learn a brand new language at this point in your life?" The rabbi said, "Well, I did apply for an exit visa to be able to leave Russia. If they give me the exit visa, I want to go to Israel. They speak this language in Israel. I want to learn the language and speak it before I get there." An agent told Rabbi, "Well, I already know from my contacts in the Kremlin, they decided to turn your request down. You will not get the exit visa. You will die here in Mother Russia. May as well stop trying to learn this new language." "Oh, no," said the rabbi. "I must still learn it, because if I do die here in Russia, I'll go to heaven. They speak the language in heaven. I want to speak when I get there." Well, the agent thought he'd be smart with the rabbi and said, "Well, Rabbi, suppose you end up in hell." Rabbi said, "That's no problem. I already speak Russian." And the last one I'm going to tell you for today is, comes from New York City, actually. It was a rabbi that had an Orthodox synagogue, a small synagogue, and they were able to pay him enough to meet his needs, but never much money left over. And so he had this great desire to visit Israel, but never had enough money to go. But after several years, a donation came in with that specification. He could not go to Israel for a whole month. It was enough money to bring his wife with him, so he asked her to come with him. And she said, "Well, if I go, I will have to bring my mother with me." And being an Orthodox rabbi, of course, understood the Old Testament, nothing about the New. And the rabbi says, "You know, honey, that's not a good idea. Let's be honest, your mother and I simply don't get along. Every time she comes over, we have at least one argument, sometimes two. We'll be in Israel for 30 days. That's 30 arguments, maybe 60 arguments, or somewhere in between. I don't think this is a good idea." Well, his wife said, "Well, if I go to Israel, I don't think of my mother, I'll never hear the end of it. She will crutch, she will complain, she'll put me to an early grave. To keep peace in the family, either you just go by yourself, that's fine with me, but if you want me to go, I will have to bring your mother with me." Rabbi said, "Well, I don't want to go alone, so go ahead and bring your mother, I'll find a way to live with it." Well, off they go, and soon as the rabbi was afraid, every day they were having one argument, sometimes two. About halfway in the trip, they come to Jerusalem, and while they're there, his mother has a sudden heart attack and passes away. Now the rabbi has to find a way to get the body back to New York City to be buried in a special Jewish cemetery in the family plot there. And so he went to the American consulate and asked them, and they told him, because there's so much red tape in Israel, that'll be very expensive. It'll cost you about $30,000. But he said to the rabbi, "Listen, she's a Jewish woman. She can be buried right here in Jerusalem. It'll only cost you $3,000, and that will save you a lot of money." The rabbi thought for a moment or two, but then said, "No, no, 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 no. No matter what the cost, I want the body brought back to Jerusalem, to New York. I'll find a way to pay for it later." The consulate worker said, "You must really love your mother-in-law to put out all these funds." And the rabbi said, "Well, to be honest, that's not quite where I'm coming from. I remember a story. Now, I don't remember how I heard the story. Did somebody tell me the story? Maybe I read it somewhere. But I recall hearing of a story of a man who was buried here in Jerusalem, but then 3 days later he came back to life. I can't take that chance." "You're dismissed."